Welcome to Compromising Positions. I'm Leanne Potter, cyber anthropologist and head of security operations for a major retailer.
And I'm Jeff Watkins, a cybersecurity enthusiast and CTO for a major tech consultancy. Together, we're the tech podcast that asks non-cybersecurity professionals what we in the industry can do to make their lives easier.
And help make our organizations more prepared to face ever-changing human-centric cyber threats.
We've had quite an incredible few weeks at Compromising Positions HQ, haven't we?
It's been really exciting.
Well, first, we presented a new talk as Compromising Positions at the Future of Cybersecurity Conference in Manchester.
Yeah, and that was really well received. It was an anthropological, philosophical, behavioural science-esque look at how we in the cybersecurity industry are going to need to approach AI. And it's called Wearable, Shareable and Bearable, and I will put a link in the show notes to that video.
Yeah, I really loved delivering it, and I think, and the other feedback has said, that we brought a bit of a unique take to the conversation on AI. You also appeared on that famous cybersecurity podcast, Smashing Security, didn't you, Leanne?
It was an absolute highlight of my career, and Graham Cluley and Carol Terrio were absolutely lovely, incredible. So yeah, I was on Smashing Security. I would say check it out, but I think most listeners in this industry already do. But we also had some wonderful news, didn't we, Jeff?
Well, we did indeed. And thank you to all our listeners for making it happen. During February, we charted at number 17 in the top technology podcasts in the UK. We're also in the top 20 and high up in the charts in the US and other countries too.
We are so delighted that this show is finding an audience, and we can't thank you enough, listeners. So thank you so much for sharing. Wow, what a month. What have we got to look forward to this week, Jeff?
Well, this week we're joined by Sabrina Segal, an integrity, risk and compliance advisor with almost 20 years of experience in the public, private and third sectors.
In this episode, not new but novel, tackling risk in the third sector, we're taking a look at the challenges facing the third sector when it comes to cybersecurity technology and risk. But this isn't your typical risk discussion, and the risks the third sector faces aren't the same as other industries.
No, and Sabrina has a really refreshing take on risk. We can't wait for you to hear how she enables her clients to get to grips with what she calls tolerable risk. We can't avoid risks, nor should we. So why not learn how you can reframe risk to not only identify threats, but also opportunities?
While at the same time, making sure that everyone cares about risk, not just people with risk manager in their title. And she also shares with us some really interesting experiences about cyber attacks in the third sector.
Oh, we love this chat so much that we had to make another two-parter episode. So don't forget to subscribe for free so you won't miss part two, where Sabrina gives us a literal step-by-step guide on our risk model, OCRM, Objective-Centered Risk Management.
Trust me, you don't want to miss that one. I've never heard of such an approachable and practical risk management process. But alas, that is something for you to enjoy next week. But in the meantime, sit back and enjoy our interview with Sabrina Segal.
Today we have a great guest for you, Sabrina Segal, who is an integrity, risk and compliance advisor, international development and humanitarian assistance professional, licensed US attorney, certified fraud examiner with almost 20 years of experience in the public, private and third sectors. Wow, that's a mouthful. How do you manage to do all that?
It's something. It keeps me off the streets. It keeps me out of trouble. Thank you both for having me on the podcast today. I'm super excited to be here to talk about the third sector and risk, and how folks can start to think about working with charities and nonprofits around risk and even particularly data protection risk too. But yeah, I mean, my background, I've been in the third sector. And so when the point of definition here, the third sector, when I use that term, is basically charities and nonprofits. So that term was developed because you have the private sector, right? You have the government sector, and then you have the third sector. I've been in the third sector now for, 20 years almost. Makes me feel really old thinking about that. But I decided to use my powers for good instead of evil when I got out of law school. And I worked for the government for a while for USAID and the Department of State, focusing on international development, humanitarian assistance. I also worked for a few agencies of the government doing oversight, working for inspectors general. And after that, I said, I'm tired of working for the government. I want to get closer to the programming, closer to the projects. So I moved overseas and I advised on some rule of law programs in Afghanistan for a while. I was working in a Syrian refugee camp in Jordan, worked for a brief stint with a private consulting company, doing international development, and kind of didn't feel great doing that and got back into the nonprofit area. And I've been really lucky with my career in that I've been able to kind of work from headquarters all the way down to frontline in the field, working in program as well as working in oversight and compliance with my legal background. And I've been able to see the sector from a lot of different facets and angles. And that's kind of gotten me to where I am today, focusing on specifically risk and compliance in the third sector. So I have my own consulting company, so to speak, called Tolerable Risk. I also have my own podcast called Tolerable Risk. And really what I focus on is trying to engage organizations in a kind of well thought through conversation about risk. Risk management is something that has been established in the private sector, banks, petrochemical companies, aviation, they're all doing risk management. But it's risk management that's really fit for purpose for them. There hasn't been anything developed so far that's really fit for purpose for the third sector. And we are a unique sector. You know, we're not sparkly special unicorns and everything. But when it comes to engaging around risk and the types of programming that we do, the operating environments that we work in, it is unique. And so we need to have a unique point of view and a unique approach to risk as well. And so that's what I've been working on recently in my career, is advising organizations, particularly around approach that I like called objective-centered risk management, which we can talk about later, but kind of getting them to understand that, you know, you don't just need to slap a risk matrix into your proposal and tick the box. If you genuinely are doing risk well, it brings really, really impactful value, not only to the programs that you're designing, but to the beneficiaries and participants that you're serving. So I really am trying to bring risk to the forefront, trying to get people to talk more about it in the sector. And I'm really glad to be on your podcast today to talk about risk in the third sector.
Yeah. And it's a side that we haven't touched yet, the third sector. Now, my background is the third sector as well, so I've got a lot of love for that area, but I also know that there is a lot of challenges there. It really does not function like any other sector by design in some ways, and also unfortunately just by finance. Your podcast is called Tolerable Risk. Tell me more about what is a tolerable risk.
Yeah, so actually it's interesting. I get that question fairly frequently. So I came up with the term tolerable risk because, you know, if you think about charities and nonprofits are delivering a service or a good maybe in a space that has been essentially abandoned by government and private sector, right? We are filling cracks, very, very big cracks in some cases if we're talking about poverty or things like that. The private sector and the government have just sort of turned away from for whatever reason. And so when you're functioning in a space that nobody else wants to function in, there's usually a reason why. And one of those reasons why is that there's higher risk. So, you know, charities and nonprofits function in a higher risk environment simply by the fact of what they're delivering and their mission and their purpose right out of the gates. So organizations, charities and nonprofits have to accept that they are going to be facing risk, and they have to accept that risk. The question is, how much risk can they tolerate? And so that's kind of where the term tolerable risk came from, was saying, look, we are not going to avoid risk. You are not going to be able to just function doing what you're doing, delivering the services that you're delivering, working with the under-recognized populations that you're working with without accepting some sort of risk. So let's think about it up front. Let's think about how it connects with the objectives that you're trying to achieve and the decisions that you need to make, and then let's move forward. And so that's really where kind of the term tolerable risk came from.
As you were thinking there, I had quite a lot of flashbacks from when my time in the third sector, and I remember working in an organization and our IT was all outsourced. There was no IT professionals in the building. I was probably the closest thing there at the time, when just because kind of dabbled in computers, but nothing major. And I remember we got completely taken out by a virus once. And what happened was, is because we didn't have an in-house IT service, we kept getting those alerts, that, you know, those pop-ups that say, please restart your machine, we've got a nice update for you. And we all just kept saying, remind me later. And this was for weeks and weeks. We're like, oh, that pop-up's really annoying. I'm trying to get on and do my job, which at the time was the brief was solve destitution in Leeds, which is the city I live in. So we were dealing with people just facing absolute dire straits. So we just needed to just be working, but we just kept clicking, remind me later, you know, we'll get to that big update. And then one day we all turned on the computers and that was it, blue screen of death. And it was just like, you've got a virus on this computer. We couldn't access the machines for a week, because we didn't have any proper IT service or anything like that. And so that service just went totally down. And that was, you know, a mixture of things, you know, due to lack of funding, but also just a lack of understanding of that wider business processes. Because when you're in the third sector, you just kind of want to roll up your sleeves and just get stuff done. You don't really think about the things like maybe a big organization has the luxury to think about. And I was wondering, from your experience, do you have any stories about cybersecurity and your experience with cybersecurity working in the third sector?
I do, in fact. So I'll give you an example of an organization that I will remain nameless, but it was a similar situation that you just described. You know, so I was working in one of the field offices, and basically the headquarters system got attacked with a ransomware. And so And unfortunately, the bad guys tend to target third sector organizations exactly for what you just said. They know that they don't have proper IT security staff members. They may be, you know, running things out of the cloud, using personal email addresses and all this stuff. And it's low-hanging fruit, right? And I mean, these organizations, they don't have a lot of money, but you could ransom their stuff for £10,000, maybe £20,000. And if there's insurance or whatever, people will pay it. So I was running a field office, and I, a lot like you, kind of dabbled in information security and all that. And I actually made my staff run a very separate type of security on all the laptops that we had in our field office. And the headquarters got hit. And so anything that we kind of had connected to the headquarters, we couldn't access anymore. But our systems were actually okay. And I was really happy about that. And again, it wasn't because I'm some computer genius, but I was just saying, you know what? I don't really like what they're running in headquarters. So I'm going to run something different. And we were able to continue functioning for the most part with the work that we needed to do. Now, you know, that's not pointing a finger and saying, you know, putting blame on anybody. That's the reality of working in a charity, is saying, you know, we're going to do the best we have with what we've got. Now, when I do talks about risk, but particularly when I know that I've got a heavy kind of private sector audience, one of the things I talk about is, you know, look, if you are listening to me right now and you're working in a private sector organization and your organization has, for example, a foundation or CSR, right, or is engaging in allowing, you know, staff to have volunteer opportunities to work with organizations, I always remind them that they need to think about funding the core elements of these organizations that they want to support. It's fantastic that you want to support an organization that is helping animals or helping the environment or is helping elderly people, right? These are all wonderful things. The programming that organizations run is why they exist. You know, I always like to say no organization is created because somebody said, oh, I want to comply with, you know, the UK procurement laws today, so I'm going to create an organization so I can do that. No, they see a need in their community and they want to fill that need. Now, what comes along with it are these operational elements, these compliance elements, these other things. So if a private sector organization, you know, folks are listening today, really consider providing resources to support the core operating elements of the organizations that you enjoy working with, right? So you can allow your staff to have volunteer hours to help with whatever the program is. Maybe it's a food bank, maybe it's, you know, tutoring children for financial literacy, whatever it is. But also, if your organization specializes in data security, give your staff time to give that organization data security support. If your organization focuses on accounting or, you know, financial, you know, whatever it is, whatever your core service is, marketing, advertising, also give some of that service to the organization, because I guarantee you, no charity organization is going to say no if you walk up to them and say, yeah, we want our staff to be able to help with the animals, but also we want to help you secure your systems. They'll probably fall over. They'll be so excited and so thrilled that you're offering this support. That's great. There's this misunderstanding in the third sector that overhead is bad, or that asking for resources to pay your staff competitively or give your staff additional training or make sure you have proper firewalls and cybersecurity set up is some sort of waste. And I think we have to get over that. We have to get over that ourselves as a sector, but we also need to start, you know, communicating this to the public and to large donors and saying funding these core elements of an organization is actually helping the programming be better, right? Because if an organization is running four different programs and you say, oh, I really like these two, I'm going to support these two. Well, that's great, you're supporting those two. But if you also support the core operating elements of the organization, not only are you supporting those two programs, but you're supporting all four, right? A rising tide floats all boats. If you help strengthen that organization, their work is going to be so much more impactful. So, you know, cybersecurity is a great area to focus on for charities and nonprofits, because it is something where they usually are woefully under-resourced.
Absolutely. And there's just so much you could do in that space. And I think from the perspective as an individual, actually utilizing my actual skills would make me feel even more like I was contributing. So there's one thing to say that, you know, being invited to a youth center and saying, paint the wall. Yeah, I can do that. Gets me out of the office. But to really have impact and going, you know, my time and skills are, you know, costly. My expertise is rare. Putting those into practice and play actually for the benefit. And again, Having also worked in the third sector, as you say, Sabrina, you cannot understate how lacking it is in that core, those core areas. No, and again, not out of, you know, neglect or anything like that. They're just, their goal is to serve that need. And that's just something that we can all really help with. And I think that really helps us understand the different risks appetite in the third sector as well, which is one of the reasons why I wanted to get you on, because there's one thing to talk about risk appetite in a private sector, but when you're dealing with the most vulnerable people in society often, or, you know, non-profits, low resources and things like that, that risk appetite is something you have to come from a completely different angle.
Do you think there's an element of kind of the equivalent of greenwashing when it comes to charity days for organizations? As in, I noticed this a lot, and this has been something that I've had the opinion of, like if especially a tech firm offering to do a litter pick or work at a soup kitchen, very nice, and you get some nice photographs out of it and you get to post it on LinkedIn, but it feels a little bit like whatever the charity equivalent of greenwashing is, when actually just doing some, say, some cybersecurity work, some infrastructure work under the hood, probably like 50 times more valuable to the org, but people don't seem to be doing it that much.
Absolutely. I agree with you 100%. If you had a technology company that said, we want to come in and we want to give you volunteer hours to help improve your systems, that would actually be a billion times more valuable than a litter pick or painting a wall or whatever it is, you know, sorting cans. Because they've got plenty of organizations who have, can send in volunteers. You have retirees and things like that who can come in and sort cans. But if your listeners and the two of you, you know, you have a very specific skill set that is extremely valuable for charities and nonprofits, absolutely, 100%. And Leanne, you had mentioned, you know, risk appetite earlier. You know, risk appetite is something that personally, I hate it. Along with risk matrices and risk registers, I can burn them with fire. What I prefer to talk about is, you know, what's our risk awareness? Because risk appetite, again, in the third sector, it's what you know, what can you tolerate? But it's what are we aware of is really what it comes down to more. And unfortunately, charities and nonprofits don't necessarily have a lot of say in that sometimes, because again, the environments that they're working in, if they want to be able to deliver impactful programming for underrecognized communities, they're going to be working in a higher risk environment. So what they're sort of almost forced into just by sake of their existence is not a luxury, and it's something that they need to be able to build their systems and their approaches and their decision making around. And, you know, I mean, there was a really, really sad story that was, I mean, it was 2 years ago now or 3 years ago, about how one of the UN agencies agreed to share one of their biometric databases with a government. You can find, people can Google this, they can find it, you know, online. But basically, where there was a refugee camp, and in the way that the UN is starting to do things in some of these camps is they're doing cash transfer so people can actually buy things off the economy. And in order to do that, they're either using fingerprints or they're using iris scans or things like that in order to do biometrics to have their systems be more secure. But the government where these programs were run essentially came up and said, you know what, if you want to continue to run these programs, you have to share the biometric data with us. And they were arguing that it was for safety and security, terrorism purposes. The UN agreed. And, you know, now not every small and medium.
Something doesn't feel right about that.
Yeah. Exactly. Now, not every small and medium-sized charity is going to be working with, you know, refugees or potential political, you know, outsiders and things like that. But if you are working with communities and you are doing some sort of distribution or you're tracking progress of people who are going through your programs, you have personally identifiable information. And again, the people who are engaging with charities tend to be the most vulnerable people among us. And so there are really, you know, sensitivities that charities need to think about that a lot of other organizations don't. You know, when you sign up for Facebook or Twitter or whatever the heck it is now, you know, I mean, people are giving away their data, they're posting their images, they're posting where they live, all that stuff, that's fine, right? But when you are dealing with a population that's engaging with an organization because they are in need, you need to think about it differently. The other thing that I talk about is, you know, I think, Jeff, what you were mentioning, you know, it's a great to get pictures and you can put it on LinkedIn and things like that. There, you'll see in a lot of these fundraising drives, you know, pictures of children, pictures of needy people, things like that, in order to get people to donate money. And sometimes during events that organizations have, you know, they take pictures. Now, the good ones will say, can I have your permission to take this picture? And this is how we're going to use it. Typically, what happens is they make an announcement at the beginning of the event and say, we're going to take some pictures, you know, let us know if you have a problem. Now, there's a power dynamic when we talk about that, right? Because if you have people who are coming to receive something, some sort of good or some sort of training or whatever, and they don't want their picture taken, but they perceive the fact that in order for them to receive that thing of value, they must agree to have their picture taken. That's a concern. And so we also need to be thinking about privacy when it comes to these things, because digital pictures can travel everywhere. And you might be doing a CV writing program, right? You might be doing one of those Dress for Success programs, and you might be taking pictures, and the person who's participating might not want people to know that they're doing that, right? For whatever reason, and it's their right. So organizations that are using digital images, that are gathering, you know, privacy protected information about individuals who are going through their programs or receiving their goods, also need to think about strengthening security around there. Maybe not because they're concerned about a government, you know, coming after them, but simply for the personal privacy of an already vulnerable population that they're serving.
That's a very interesting point about the duress of that. You know, being under duress because you need the use of that service. I mean, arguably nobody needs to use Facebook, but we sign up for it. And when we don't do so under any due duress, I imagine being somewhere where you, for example, something like a food bank or something, I imagine that being felt like you are being compelled to come to make a, enter into a contract is pretty ethically dodgy situation to be in.
Even to the extent of actually funding drive. X organization, maybe government organization, says, I've got a big pot of money that I want to give to charities to meet a need. However, in order for you to accept this funding, we'll give you what you need to meet the needs of the people you're trying to help. However, the caveat is I need this data. And when you're a charity, you have to make those kind of decisions unfairly, because what do you say? Do you turn down money? Those areas of that funding drive I've found in my experience to be quite holding you ethically over a barrel sometimes in terms of what is the quid pro quo of you getting this funding. And I think when you bring it back to cybersecurity, if you were working, let's say you are a larger charity and you do actually have maybe a cybersecurity person working there, and someone comes to you, oh, we need to give this data, and you turn around and go, oh, we can't do that. Because me as a cybersecurity person, that goes against everything of best practice. But they turn around and say, well, if we don't do this, then we don't get the money to do this. And you don't get paid, we don't get paid. That service doesn't happen. So what decision are you going to make? And I was going to ask you, how do you navigate conversations where you don't get the funding if you don't play ball? And when it comes to risk in your experience?
I mean, that's a really hard one. And that's one that, you know, with what's going on in the world right now, a lot of organizations are genuinely having to face. Even in a more benign way, organizations have always kind of had to face the question of, for example, the vice industries, right? Alcohol, tobacco, firearms, people who create weapons of war. They have foundations. They donate resources. Do you want to accept that, right? Well, I don't know. Maybe if you're an agriculture organization, maybe you'll accept, you know, money from tobacco and alcohol. If you're an organization that's focused on children and children's rights and children's safety, probably not, right? You know, if you're an organization that's focused on literacy and entrepreneurship, maybe you will accept money from, you know, engineering companies that make bombs and jet fighters. It's really up to each organization to determine where their red line is. And it can be hard sometimes, because right now we're in, you know, every organization, all my fundraising friends are saying it's getting harder and harder to identify resources. But at the same time, you don't want to sell out. You know, I hate to be frank there, but, you know, it's like, do you sell out? And then what does that do to your mission and your purpose? And what message does that send to your beneficiaries and participants? Bringing it back to compliance, you know, this is, again, one of the reasons why the third sector is very unique. In the private sector and the government sector, you very clearly have the person who's selling and the person who's buying, right? Or you have the person who's providing the service and the person who's receiving the service. In the third sector, we have this very strange tripartite arrangement where you have the back donors, you have the organization who's then implementing the project or the program or the activities, and then you have the beneficiaries and the participants. So if you are that organization that's implementing the program or the project or their activities, who exactly is your customer, quote unquote? Is it the back donor? Or is it the beneficiary and the participant? And this is something very, very unique to the third sector. No bank has to deal with that. No, I mean, you have regulators, fine. No bank has to deal with that. No aerospace engineering, you know, firm has to deal with that. You know, no. This is something that and we have to wrestle with all the time. And it's nothing new in the third sector, right? Because you sometimes have those donors that just really want to roll up their sleeves and get into your business. And that's the only way you can get those resources. And the question is, you want to make sure that they feel that they're participating, but you also want to make sure that your program design is not driven by the donor, which is what has happened over the past several decades in this sector. And that has what has triggered now more recently this conversation about the decolonization of humanitarian aid and localization efforts, bringing more of these local communities to the table to discuss what are the programs going to deliver and all of that. Because you could have somebody in Copenhagen or in Rome saying, you know, the folks in Uganda need X, Y, and Z. And the folks in Uganda are saying, actually, we don't need that at all. We need something completely different. And that voice has not been heard. We're doing better now lately, bringing these voices to the table and giving them the space that they need to kind of co-create some of these things. But we still have a long way to go.
Mm. Do you find that when you go into a new organization that a lot of the sector really isn't geared up to understand risk as much as maybe a public or a private sector organization are? And I guess, how do you actually make risk a value-added member of the team?
That's a great question. So the answer is yes. Usually what I say about the third sector is risk management is not new to the third sector. It is novel. And I say that because, again, charities and nonprofits have had to manage risk since the beginning, right? Since the dawn of time that a charity has existed. Again, like I said in the beginning, we've worked in high-risk environments. It's just the nature of the beast. But this push to have more structure around it, and particularly the push by donors and funders to have more accountability, is something that is more recent and more new. Now, unfortunately, the donors and the funders and the sector itself basically said, okay, we're going to look around and see what's out there that's labeled quote unquote risk, and we're going to just slap it in. And so that's how we've now ended up with risk matrices, risk registers, and risk appetite statements in the third sector, which really are not fit for purpose. They really are not fit for purpose. Frankly, they're not fit for purpose in any sector. And we can have a whole nother conversation about that. For the charities, they're really not fit for purpose. So, you know, when I go into organizations and I start talking about risk, I really tie it back to, what are we trying to achieve? What are our objectives? And that's why I start with that. And, you know, it's also the whole idea of, what is the person's title who's managing risk, right? If the person's title is chief risk officer or risk manager, what you're signaling to the rest of the organization is that person's there to manage risk, so I don't have to do anything. So I actually advise organizations to change the titling around this role and call it risk advisor, or, you know, risk support team, or things like that, because then that signals to everybody that you are a risk manager too. I actually have little buttons and stickers that I have made up that say, I am a risk manager too, and you can hand those out, right? So that everybody understands that they are not only expected, but empowered to manage threats and opportunities. So one of the things that I do when I do training is I talk about how risk is like a two-sided coin. We have threats, which are the horrible things that happen, right? But we also have opportunities. And so many times when we do risk management, we forget about the opportunities. And so when you're going into particularly a charity, and I just start to talk about risk, I really heavily emphasize opportunities in the beginning because it gets people excited. So one of the examples I'll give is this. I'll say, let's say, for example, you're doing a program around literacy, around childhood literacy, or even adult literacy, right? And you're going into this community and you estimate that, you know, 50 people are going to be interested. So you plan your project and your budget around 50 people. Well, what happens if your program is so popular that you have another 20 people that want to sign up? How quickly can we adjust so that we can accommodate those additional 20 people so we can get them literate? And people go, oh, that's really exciting. Wait, that's risk? Wait, I thought risk was just a long list of horrible things that might happen. And you go, no. Yes, risk is trying to make sure we're prepared for the threats, but risk is also trying to make sure we're prepared for the opportunities. And so you can get people really excited by looking at that positive angle as much as the negative angle. And so we really, again, in the third sector, need to start looking at risk as something that is integrated into the ways of working. And so I talk a lot about being built in and not bolted on.
Built in, not bolted on. Love that. I think applicable to any sector, not just the third sector when it comes to integrating risks. Now, you've worked in loads of other sectors before, Jeff, but not in the third sector, is that right?
Private and public sector only, but not the third sector. So hearing about the challenges and complexity that goes with it was absolutely eye-opening.
As a sector, it doesn't get the love it deserves from a tech perspective, let alone from a cyber perspective. So I was really glad that we were able to get such a powerhouse in Sabrina to kind of guide us through this, not often traversed, but super vital part of the social fabric. I'm really hoping that our our listeners in cyber really take heed to her call to action about those charity days and think about how we can use our amazing skills in cybersecurity and tech to make a huge difference to the operational delivery of these organizations.
I really loved her take on job titles too. Perception is everything, and she's right. As soon as you stick manager on something,
risk manager, information security manager,
precisely, people think, oh, that's their job, of course they're going to take care of it, and that makes it a nightmare to get other people to care about what you're actually managing.
And I really liked the use of badges for this purpose. Rather than just having one risk manager, why not make everyone a risk manager so they all have to care?
Well, we can only try and hope. Well, our lovely listeners, we are delighted to let you know that next week you're in for a treat. In part two of our interview with Sabrina, she's going to walk us through the risk model that has made her famous, the OCRM, Objective-Centered Risk Management Model. Risk registers, risk matrices, and other compliance tick boxes are not fit for purpose, according to Sabrina.
And when she showed us the Objective-Centered Risk Management Model, we have to agree, this might be revolutionary in approaching risk in your organization. So don't miss it, and the best way not to miss it is to follow us on the very platform you're listening to right now. So go on, you're so close. Click that button. It's absolutely, totally free.
Links to everything Sabrina discussed in this episode can be found in the show notes. And if you like the show, please do leave us a review and a share on LinkedIn or in your teams. It really helps us spread the word and get high-quality guests like Sabrina on future episodes.
We hope you enjoyed this episode. See you next time. Keep secure, and don't forget to ask yourself, am I the compromising position here?